Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Jump Ship edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. I'm joined by Slate Money Box columnist Jordan Wiseman.
Hello, lovely listeners.
And also a woman with some news, Ms. Kathy O'Neill.
Hi.
Hi. The author of Weapons of Mass Destruction. We are going to be talking about her news later on in the show. You're going to want to hear that. We are also going to be talking about... Well, I mean, Kathy, this is what you always want to talk about,
yeah,
right? It's banks behaving badly evil things they do.
Terrible.
So we're going to talk about that. But first, we're going to talk about the wonderful world of Donald Trump's executive orders and other signs of madness. Jordan, what? Remind us what TPP is.
Yes. So TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You may recall it was that giant controversial trade deal involving... 12 different nations, including the United States, Canada, Mexico, Japan, Vietnam, so on and so forth, covering 40% of the world's GDP. Barack Obama negotiated, and it became massively controversial.
So TPP was going to be the sort of Asia-Pacific version of NAFTA.
It was going to include the NAFTA nations. It was going to be...
Except it was not going to include China.
No, it was not going to include China.
And then we had a presidential election where both candidates said they were opposed to it.
Exactly.
And then, as was promised by both candidates, once one of them was elected, the one who got elected said, I'm not going to do this.
Yes.
And so is this news interesting, important, or is it just entirely expected?
Well, I think so. It is important. I mean, the news itself is as expected. No one thought Donald Trump was going to turn around and sign TPP. That was abundantly clear. I should say that, he is basically withdrawing as a signatory. Trade deals like this don't ever really die. They can get put on ice. There is nothing stopping in like 10 years from now, another president coming and reviving TPP. But for now, it's in a coma. It's done for now. There are kind of philosophical reasons there. It's interesting, but the news itself is just sort of what we all saw coming.
And so I'm actually really not sad that TPP is gone. There were a lot of problems with TPP, which we talked about.
Yeah.
In particular, the amount of power that went to these bodies, what are they called?
ISDS. International Arbitration.
But one of the things that Obama kept on saying was that the reason we're getting TPP, even though it's imperfect, was that basically because China's not in it.
Yeah.
And now that we actually said, like, as Trump said, like, screw it, really not doing this.
Yeah.
It does seem like China has taken on a different role.
Well,
so China has its own replacement lined up, and it's called...
It's the regional comprehensive... Yeah, it's the regional comprehensive trade agreement. And this is something I've talked to some people about, and there are two minds, right? They're the people who didn't like TPP. People like Public Citizen or groups like Public Citizen, Lori Wallach over there, who was sort of like the original anti-trade crusader, who will say, yes, China is going to bring people into this other trade deal, but this other trade deal is kind of bullshit. It's a very minor thing. It's lowering some tariffs. It's not fundamentally restructuring anyone's economy the way TPP would have. It's not something where China's really rewriting the rules of the global economy, like TPP's advocates are saying.
Okay, so I'm going to jump in here and say you're really overselling TPP if you think it was going to rewrite the rules of the global economy or fundamentally change anything. I feel that what we have with where we've reached in terms of the panoply, to use a local term, of bilateral trade agreements, along with the WTO rules, which govern everything, as along with the European Union and all of that kind of stuff, and NAFTA and Mercosur, is that we have a world which, to all intents and purposes, kind of has free trade already. And all of these agreements are twiddling around with the services industry and a little bit of intellectual property here and there, and trying to add a bit and trying to add a piece and trying to sort of change a few things at the margin. But there's literally no trade deal which is going to rewrite the rules of anything.
Okay, so it's not about... I think it's beyond twiddling. I think when you talk about things like ISDS and further, which is, you know, further solidifying this extra, you know, supranational judicial procedure, that's actually a big deal as that creeps on. I think when you talk about the intellectual property rules and what governs pharmaceuticals, those, or biologics, those are a big deal. I think that, you know, expanding intellectual property rights abroad in general are actually, you know, again, it's not about tariffs per se, but these non-tariff rules really do change the way business works.
Well, if we're going to talk about changing the rules, like, what do we think Trump is actually
And
this is actually the meat of where we need to talk about, which is the big elephant in the room, and let's just name it. NAFTA is the, you know, the shining trade deal on a hill signed by Bill Clinton, which kind of really did change the entire North American economy and created these supply chains which stretch all the way from Canada to Mexico. And I will just say that the whole concept of Mexican imports and Mexican exports, it has kind of been rendered incoherent by NAFTA, because now everyone just makes everything everywhere. And almost anything you buy in the United States will have something in it which was, you know, in Mexico at some point. And yet, in the face of this clearly, you know, facts on the ground, single trade area that we've had for a long time now, Donald Trump is talking about throwing up tariffs and taxing Mexican imports and tearing up NAFTA. And that's something which Hillary Clinton would never have done. And that's kind of scary, no?
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to a union guy who does trade for like a very large American labor union, and he has to remain anonymous, sadly. But I asked him, I was like, you guys have had problems with NAFTA. You know, is it a good thing if it goes away? If Donald Trump actually just withdrew, would you be happy about it? And his response is, I can't even imagine that world. Like he couldn't even tell me if he'd be happy or sad, because it's so inconceivable how you would unravel this giant, just a deal that governs every part of the supply chain in North America.
Even this is a little bit like Brexit, right? Like you can say that you want to do it, but actually doing it is impossible.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, like you're saying, Felix, one car, when you make it, the supply chain just goes back and forth over the border in Texas, into the Midwest, back into Mexico, back and forth. And so,
and Canada, don't forget Canada.
Yeah, and Canada. And so there's just, you have these extremely complicated supply chains that cross borders freely right now, and you would just have to remake how you manage all of that. It's really just hard to wrap your mind about.
Or if you want to be really concrete, as I understand it, like the trucking that goes from Mexico into Texas and all through the country, is like, what's the plan there? Do we like stop every truck at the border?
Well, that's going to be a wall.
Yeah.
But I mean, it just would disrupt our economy.
And one of the more depressing things that I've seen is that the Canadians, rather than standing up and full-throatedly supporting NAFTA, which has been extremely good for the Canadian economy, which exports, you know, obviously the US and NAFTA is its number one trading partner, instead of doing that, they've kind of rolled over already, and they said, oh, well, if you want to kick out the Mexicans, then I suppose we'd better just start talking about a bilateral trade deal just between the US and Canada, because okay. And that I'm super depressed, but
that does seem like the plan. Like Trump wants to one-on-one negotiate with every single other country, right? Isn't that his plan?
Yes, it is. And so this is interesting. Another thing I've been kind of talking to trade experts about, this idea of Donald Trump likes the idea of bilateral trade negotiations. He thinks these multilateral deals, these regional deals, are bad for the US. And his reasoning is that when you have these big kind of TPP-like deals, a bunch of small countries can kind of gang up on the U.S. and say, okay, well, we're going to all join together and say, we're not going to agree to your terms. And so that gives us less leverage. So if the U.S. is just sitting across the table from New Zealand, theoretically, we're going to have more leverage with them.
He adds, by the way, yeah. This is something which I've heard from the Trump administration quite explicitly, that one of the reasons they hated TPP is because it's a trade agreement among a bunch of countries and the same rules apply to every country.
Yeah.
And what the American/Trump team is saying is, well, we're exceptional. We are the US of A. We are the global hegemon. We should get better terms than everybody else.
Yeah, which is...
I mean, that's exactly in line with Trump's personality. I mean, he's a bully and he's like, I want to be able to bully.
Yeah.
Right? And I can because I'm the United States and
it is
power.
And there are two big reasons why that doesn't really make a ton of sense as a trade strategy. The first reason is just for businesses, a bunch of bilateral trade deals are really complicated to navigate. If you have to figure out different rules for every single fucking country you're exporting to, it's just a pain in the ass.
Right.
Okay, that's number one.
It's complicated.
Yeah. You don't want to deal with that. But number two, it's probably just going to lead to fewer trade deals. And here's why. You get a bunch of countries, all of which bring different things to the table. And even though a deal between any one, two countries might not make sense, right? A deal between the group does make sense because they are all compensating factors. Mm-hmm. So the way it's sort of a three-way trade in the NBA, right?
Yeah.
That's
if you restrict trades to be two-way, there's actually fewer opportunities.
So one example is let's say, again, going back to TPP, right? Let's say, New Zealand wants to get access to the U.S. dairy market, right?
I doubt that, by the way. Doesn't New Zealand have a bunch of cows?
Yeah, it's got a lot of dairy. So, they have a lot of dairy. So, they want to send...
They
want to get access to the U.S. dairy market. That's going to piss off American farmers, right? But the compensation is, if you have Canada in the deal and they have to open their dairy market, right now, American farmers don't have much access to Canada, even under NAFTA. So American farmers get that kind of compensation. And so a two-way deal between New Zealand and America might not have worked, but a three-way deal does. Mm. And so that's why you have these multilateral trade deals. There's something for everybody. So in the end, you're not going to get a situation where when you sit down one-on-one, you're less likely to come to an agreement in a lot of ways.
But that's, yeah, I mean, there's this weird nostalgia in the Trump administration for a halcyon bygone era where most commerce in the United States was just domestic. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about, is that if you're going to tear up trade deals, you are just going to become a much more insular and less global country. And that's quite explicitly what Trump was campaigning on. He's like, I want to go back to the days when we could just, make our steel ourselves. And then, for instance, he signed an executive order saying, if we're going to be building oil pipelines, they need to be built with American steel, which is totally illegal under WTO rules. But, he's Donald Trump, so he doesn't care about that. He's going to sign these orders anyway.
The good news about the executive orders, as I've been explained to by a lot of law professors recently, is that most of them are illegal and won't happen. So we can end on a positive note.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Kathy O'Neill.
Yes.
I hear that banks have been behaving badly again.
Here's the thing. This week, the CFPB announced a settlement with Citigroup. And I should say that CFPB is doing a lot of stuff right now, trying to get...
Which is kind of amazing, right? The CFPB, which was the number one enemy of every single Republican candidate, including Donald Trump, is going out there slapping fines left, right, and center, and no one seems to be stopping them.
Well, I think they're settling as quickly as possible before they're defunded, is what I think.
Yes.
Yeah. I should say that the CFPB, for those who aren't total wonks like me myself, is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and is part of Dodd-Frank, and Liz Warren started it, but then she didn't get to run it, so that's why she's a senator. Anyway, they're like the do-gooders trying to protect consumers.
Yeah.
And the reason this is actually a very personal story to me is that when I started in Occupy in 2011, I would get, because there were a couple, news articles about me and my group, I would get emails from people saying, I'm trying to renegotiate my mortgage, but they keep on telling me that they've lost my paperwork. But I've sent them my paperwork 17 times, and they're just giving me the runaround. And what can I do? And I was like, well, I don't know what you can do. Like, I feel sorry for you, but I can't tell you how many emails I got about this. Anyway, the CFPB finally nailed Citigroup on doing exactly this, what they call the runaround for people who are trying to renegotiate their mortgages back during the financial crisis.
This is the Citi Financial arm of Citigroup, which is basically the subprime mortgage bit and the bit which everyone was complaining about during the crisis and during Occupy and that kind of thing. But it's not just the subprimes. It's also Wells Fargo in Beverly Hills.
Oh, right. Yeah, I mean, there's another story which was broken by ProPublica this week about how Wells Fargo has been doing it basically the same idea of like losing people's paperwork, quote unquote, and charging people in Beverly Hills and Los Angeles area more generally for delays that they're responsible
yeah.
for.
Yeah,
like, and those are like $1,500 charges.
See, so, this one was personal for me. Because,
oh, yeah?
Well, so...
Because you live in Beverly Hills?
No, because I recently had to go through the whole process of taking out a mortgage. And so when you have a mortgage, you have a certain date where you have to finish everything by to get the interest rate they promise you, or you have to pay more money to keep it locked in. And it's very, very, very stressful.
It
and
is.
You're trying to get all that done. And essentially what Wells Fargo was doing was they had these horribly understaffed offices in California that they could not do all the paperwork. And so inevitably the deadlines were missed, but because of Wells Fargo. So instead of saying, oh, our bad, we'll pay to extend your mortgage rate, they found ways to blame it on the customer by handing them more paperwork that wasn't actually necessary, but that would cause them to miss the deadline.
Yeah.
And therefore, they could slap them with
it. And in fact, what seems to have happened in Wells Fargo was it was not just incompetence and understaffing, although it was incompetence and understaffing to a large degree. It was also that they started treating these extension fees as a profit center.
Yeah. So there's this one guy. Actually, his name is Tom Swanson, and he's like the Wells Fargo executive in charge of the region, the Los Angeles region, that where this bad stuff happened. And by the way, 4 whistleblowers came out. That's how they found out about this bad actions. But this guy, Tom Swanson, basically created an incentive system for managers of these banks, gave them extra bonuses if they could sort of reduce the amount of late fees that the bank had to cover. So in other words, they had very direct incentives to have the people working at the banks shift those costs onto the customers. And they did so. And it was really nasty. It was because they intentionally understaffed them too.
What's fascinating is that it's not at all obvious that for all that it's nasty, it was illegal in any way. You lock in a rate for a certain amount of time, and if that certain amount of time expires, even if it's the bank's own fault, then you have two choices. You can either get the new rate, or you can pay to extend the old rate. And it's really skeevy and nasty for the bank to force you to pay to extend the old rate when it's their fault that the time has expired. But it's not.
I was under the impression that on the bank, like the bank's terms said that if they messed up, maybe I read that wrong.
Well,
bank's own terms.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the whole point. It's up to the bank. So Wells Fargo used to just say it's always the customer who pays, and then sometime after the financial crisis, they said, well, you know, obviously we've been making a bunch of mistakes, so we'll pay.
My and reading
then
of
they,
it.
And then they moved to this kind of hybrid model where they were like, well, if it's our fault, then we'll pay, and if it's not our fault, then you pay, but ultimately, it's up to them. They get to set the policy.
I think my reading of it is that, like, the AG Office of California could try to make the case, and I'm not a lawyer, but I think they could try to make the case that this was, like, deceptive and fraudulent,
dealings. If Wells Fargo says that they will cover the fee in the event that it's their fault, and then they don't, then they've basically broken their promise.
Yes.
and they're practicing deception.
And in any case, it's exceptionally bad customer service. And we have examples of people writing to... like Michael Hyde, the then president of Wells Fargo Home Lending, saying, this is what happened to me. It's not fair. You guys should pay. and nothing happens. So,
and this is where all of the Slate Money listeners just fall off their chairs. When to even dream that people might get bad customer service from a high street bank.
Yeah.
So coming back to the CFPB, right, and how like they're doing all their work before they get attacked by the Republicans in Congress. And just a little background here. Ever since it was created, there's been a giant target on this new agency.
It's like the top three targets. Yeah,
Congressional Republicans hate it. And one thing they want to do is essentially right now its funding stream comes from the Federal Reserve, and that insulates it in a lot of ways from the wrath of Congress. What they want to do is, if they can't get rid of it entirely, they want to subject it to congressional appropriations, which will then allow them to defund it, make them be able to do less. They won't be able to be as aggressive at a watchdog.
So Jordan, can you just backtrack a little bit here? Yeah. And beyond the sort of, all get lots of campaign donations from banks, like, is there any kind of ostensible reason why the congressional Republicans hate the CFPB?
I'll say one reason is that it's not just banks; it's payday lenders. Payday lenders are one of the biggest targets of the CFPB.
Yeah,
and they have a pretty big lobbying group.
And why do congressional Republicans love payday lenders?
Because they get money from the lobbying group.
Okay, right. So now we're just going back.
I don't think it's just money. It's also it is an ideological dedication to this idea of completely free markets, and that regulation gums them up, and that you would have more lending and more access to credit, et cetera, damn the consequences, whatever, buyer beware, if you did not have these watchdogs breathing down banks or payday lenders' necks.
So that's a libertarian argument, most of what the CFPB does is insists that the terms of a credit card are actually upfront and clear.
Well, they also mortgage. Republicans will tend to say that when they insist on those additional things like additional terms, all these transparency rules, that creates more bureaucracy and makes it harder to operate a community bank or whatever, or operate a business. And so, yeah, there's a lot of ideology at play. I don't think it's just campaign contributions.
But it's also particularly disingenuous ideology. I mean, if you force everyone to make it very clear how long it will take you to pay off your credit card if you make the minimum payment every month.
Right.
That's very easy to comply with. The compliance costs there are simple. The problem, the reason why the banks all hate that is because they want people to pay off the minimum every 1 month because it maximizes their interest income.
Yeah, exactly. Transparency is not the friend of banking profits. And beyond that, I think that this example you're bringing up with the mortgage problem, right? The
lost paperwork.
Yeah, the lost paperwork. Or also, Wells Fargo, what it was doing, both of these really illustrate the problem with thinking of financial services as like any other consumer market, because you don't know if you're getting good service or bad service all the time. You don't know what's normal the first time you take out a mortgage.
Pretty much always you're getting bad service.
Yeah, exactly. It is not easy to shop and compare. Like, you can look at the different rates that show up on LendingTree.com or whatever, but you can't necessarily figure out if you're getting screwed by a loan underwriter.
Credit card transparency even now is so terrible.
Yeah.
It's very hard to know exactly what the best credit card for you is.
Yeah, it's just like multiple levels. It is not a market that without someone enforcing transparency on it, someone enforcing some basic decent behavior, really lends itself to, regulation by Consumer Reports. Like, it just isn't.
Yeah, I was going to say, when Trump got elected, everybody went through the five stages of grief, right? And
I'm still on stage one.
Yeah, I was actually. It has not been a straightforward progression. There's been a lot of doubling
back.
Well,
I was going to say I went through when I realized that the CFPB was going to get defanged, I went triggered another sort of series of grief rounds, and it's a big one. I will be sorry when the CFPB is gone.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
You see, we're happy giving Kathy the last word for the next three episodes.
Definitely getting the last word on this one. In fairness, she typically does get the last word because my attempts to add something get cut. It's not as if there's any effect on the actual episode.
That's a good point.
This is like,
we should let him just do it and then we just cut it.
And then
that's
Jordan's
one of the
like,
reasons I do it.
And then Jordan's like, said the actress to the bishop. And then everyone's like, what?
By the way, we'll tell you if you want to keep it. The default
do,
is
do
cut.
Not remember the last time we had this conversation? You were like, why do you do that? I'm like, because I always add a beat so you can cut it if you need to.
I don't know how to do this one. I don't know how to do this. So, Kathy,
yeah,
what's your news?
My news is I'm leaving Slate Money.
Kathy, don't say that. What's your news?
My news is I am now a Bloomberg View columnist.
Tell me that the evil people at Bloomberg View are forcing you to leave Slate Money and it's not your fault.
Well, you can think about it that way.
forcing her big bags of money.
They do pay pretty well.
They pay better than Slate Money.
No comment. The real thing is that I'm trying to start a company, and so it's a lot of time, and I just can't do everything. To be honest, like I was thinking about it, like sustaining Slate Money and writing two columns a week, and it was exhausting to think about having that many opinions. Like per week. That's a lot of opinions to have, And it's kind of like a mental effort to have that many opinions. Like I love reading the news and I can learn information very efficiently and quickly, but then you actually you have to go an extra step and say, well, here's what I think. And that's actually a lot of work.
So tell us a little bit about...
Everyone should feel sorry for Jordan because he has to do this like every day, right?
That's literally all I do is form opinions constantly. It's exhausting.
He's a take machine, people. And never let it be said that being a take machine is an easy job. It's hard.
No. Sometimes I wish they would just... My hair is thinning. It's rough.
You look nice. So you have thick hair.
I started with a lot.
You started very, very thick.
Yeah. So obviously, Kathy O'Neill is irreplaceable and we are all inconsolable. But I do think it's worth just kind of like giving Kathy a little bit of props here for you're very clear about what you want to do professionally, how you want to achieve that, what fits in, what doesn't fit in. You're setting aspirations and goals and you're being realistic and you're raising a family and you're doing all of these different things and you're balancing your life. And I think there's a tendency for a lot of people, including myself, to just sort of say yes to everything. And that's probably maybe not wise.
Well, listen, I mean, I think I could sum up what you just said, which is very kind of you, by saying I'm really good at quitting things. I'm like a professional quitter. And like people make fun of me for this. Yeah. Like I quit a tenure track job, which was dumb, right? And then I quit a job at a hedge fund. You know, who doesn't want that job, right? Then I quit a job as data scientist, blah, blah. I'm a very episodic person.
But it's also a sign of like strength and optimism, as we've mentioned on this show in the past. The quit rate nationally is a sign of economic health. The more people quitting their jobs is a sign that things are going well. So maybe this is a sign that things are going pretty well for you.
Yeah, things are going great. And my book has had such a great reception and I'm really, really grateful. But it also my life experience has encouraged me to just go ahead and say, the next thing is going to be great too.
I was going to say though, with you, Kathy, it's not really cyclical. It's not like the economy gets better and you decide to quit more. Like it just... This is a secular trend.
Right, right. I mean, I often try to find a job before quitting the last job. I try
sometimes.
To, but that is actually not always true. Right? I quit a job and I quit the finance job in 2011, and I literally didn't know what I was going to do with my life. And I sat around thinking maybe I should work for like City Harvest.
Now, is it possible? I guess if you actually do wind up getting a job, you'll even be firing yourself, right? Now that you're self-employed, you'll be like, I quit this whole self-employment thing.
So I started this company, which is to say like my friend who's a lawyer filed an S-corp. So I have a technical legal entity. I just got an EIN for tax purposes, but I have no clients. Like it's a zero revenue company.
Do you want...
My company's called O'Neill Risk Consulting and Algorithmic Auditing, which I call, it's ORCA for short. ORCA. And the idea is I would like have clients who have algorithms that they're using that they're worried are illegal or discriminatory. It turns out like nobody cares. Not yet. I haven't managed to get any. So I'm talking to people inside the insurance industry. I'm talking to people inside the HR,
so, you know, you need,
algorithmic
you need
industry.
You need a good lobbyist to create more regulations so that you can consult about how to deal with those regulations.
It's like the worst time ever to start a company that depends on regulations.
Yeah. You did pick an interesting time for that.
Yeah. And so I'm really like,
I feel like you should be bought by IBM. I feel like this is what the main thing IBM does these days is it buys consultancies, which it can then like sell their services to its various suite of clients.
I have given myself like a timer. Like,
but the good news is that like now, instead of just going to work for IBM, you can be acquired by IBM, which is a much better thing.
What does that mean?
It means they buy
Orca. Water.
they buy your company to
they
hire
buy
you.
Your company in order to hire you, and then generally that means you get more money.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. But then I have to work for IBM.
That yes, it does.
I mean,
I might have to fire myself if that happens.
You might have to. There will be a contract clause that says you cannot quit.
Like, one of the things I've noticed is that like over time I've had less and less patience for having a boss.
Interesting.
So I'm really hoping this having a company thing works out, because otherwise I might have to have a boss someday.
So Kathy, since you're going to be on for two more episodes,
yeah,
and then you're not going to be on,
yeah.
And so what we need from you is some words of advice,
okay,
for Slate Money hosts, which we can then pass on some of your hard-earned institutional wisdom.
What have you learned about dealing with
the most important thing is like you have to like interrupt men a lot.
it's kind of stand firm,
you know. Is that not the advice you guys were looking for?
Well, it is sort of an interrupt or be interrupted show.
Yeah.
Like, that is sort of our MO.
In a kind of happy, you know, this is, I'm going to keep talking, so you might as well stop, you know, kind of way.
Yeah.
But that's important.
And dear listeners, given that Kathy is not going to be on this show much longer, we do want to hear from you with all of your ideas about what we should do with this empty chair that is not really replaceable, but we're going to try.
Yeah, I mean, look, I was kind of kidding, but the truth is, like, the thing that's really great about being a Slate Money co-host or whatever my job is you get to learn, you get to sort of like have an excuse to sit down and really think about three things a week, three topics a week. You get to sort of say, well, what are the facts here? Like, you really get to look some facts up and remember them, which is something that I don't find I do when I'm just reading the news, right? Like, you don't like focus very much. I think the best part, though, of my 3 years here, because it's been almost 3 years.
Oh my God.
Jesus, I know.
Christ.
Wow.
That's crazy. Has been all the wonderful people that we've met, and all the authors, all the guests. I mean, really, I would sum
and
it up
Paul
by
Ford.
Saying,
we get to meet Paul Ford.
I was going
to
say, like,
you got
what
a
did
hug.
I accomplish here? I met Paul Ford. And I got a hug.
And you got a hug. So, but dear listeners, one of the things that we find in this sort of journalistic world of Slate and Fusion and Slate Money is that when we draw up lists for potential people like that we would like to have on the show and maybe even have as a co-host, those lists tend to be extremely journalist heavy.
Yeah.
So if you guys know people who don't have sort of professional fetters which would prevent them from having strong opinions on all manner of subjects, who do understand business and finance, who are happy to interrupt me and tell me that I'm full of shit.
And they're women.
And are women, because that's obviously...
We need a woman here.
It has to be a woman. Then do let us know. Oh, and who are also willing to schlep out to Brooklyn every Friday morning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That this is the criteria.
If you know an opinionated finance geek in Brooklyn who is female,
or anywhere in the, you know, subway commuting distance. Kathy comes from the Upper West Side.
It's true. I do.
Which is like
miss these subway rides.
That's like as far away as Philadelphia.
It's like coming from Los Angeles, really. I will miss you guys.
We will miss you more than you will miss us, because you're going to be living your fabulous life and we're going to be stuck in the Slate Money studio.
You guys are going to be awesome.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Okay, so it's the numbers round, people. The third from last numbers round that Kathy will ever participate
in. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, then I should go first because my number is 3.3%.
Okay.
Percent. And that's how many women are no longer in the workforce since 1999. We used to have 77% of women in the workforce, and now we have 73.7%. So it's gone down by 3.3%. And that's very different.
Percentage points.
Percentage points. Yes.
There you go. For the nerds among you.
Oh, my goodness. You're so right. And that's in stark contrast to most other like countries that we usually compare ourselves to. Like the workforce in, you know, most European countries have gone up since 1999. We have gone down. And there was an interesting article in the New York Times about this trend. And the article I thought was mistitled. The article was when women quit, they do it for different reasons than for men. But inside the article, they were talking about how when women quit, they basically quitting because they have to take care of their aging parents, because they're taking care of their children, and they're sometimes taking care of their husbands. Mm-hmm. And when men quit, they play video games. Yeah. So I think the title should have been like, women don't quit, they just stop getting paid.
Yeah.
Jordan, what's your number?
500. My number is 500. That's how many years of inequality data or wealth inequality data a economist named Guido Alfani looked at. He tracked stats in six different European countries from 1300 to 1800, and then combined that with Thomas Piketty and Company's data, you know, that spans after that. And basically, the big takeaway they found, and I'm not 100% sold on this study, but it's interesting, is that like the only things that caused wealth inequality to decrease, made the rich get less rich, were pretty much the Black Death and World War One.
Wow.
Like those were the things that like, those were like the big events.
So we're like looking for a plague here?
Is yeah. That... So like it takes a lot, like, you know, if they're right, like capitalism's natural machinery really does seem to sort of lend itself to.
R is greater than G, as the man said.
Yeah.
My number, I am beholden to my colleague Patrick Hogan for this one, but it's based off this. My number is 5,000. 5,000 is the number of gigabits per second throughput rate that you would get if you hired a Amazon truck. Okay, so this is a thing. Because we're living in this wonderful world of big data now, and if you have a lot of data and you want to put it in the Amazon cloud, there's the obvious question of how do I physically get all of this data onto the Amazon cloud? And Amazon has an answer for you, which is they will send a truck and they will back it up to your loading dock, and you can put all of your data onto the truck, up to 100 petabytes of data on this truck. And then they will drive it off to their cloud storage facility and they will just plug it in. And amazingly,
it's become a physical thing.
It's a physical thing. Amazingly, if you drove a truck with 100 petabytes of data from New York to Los Angeles, like all the way across the country, the effective throughput rate there is 5,000 gigabits a second.
That is crazy. That's just so because there's just so many zeros in a petabyte.
I know. Damn.
So, like, that really is.
It's actually efficient.
We're actually like through the looking glass on data here. It just
my mind was just
like,
blown.
If you want to like, you know, communicate data, just put it on a truck.
It's like the old thing about like the tubes get it, like the internet's tubes like getting clogged because there wasn't enough room on the truck from Ted Stevenson. It's actually become real.
It's a real thing. And you can, yeah, but I mean, everyone's saying this is going to be the plot of Fast and Furious 9, you know?
I'll watch that one.
Okay, so that is on which note? We are going to leave you imagining like what you would do with 100 petabytes of data on a truck. And we will be back next week. But for now, thank you for listening to Slate Money. Thank you to Zach Dinerstein, the producer, to the executive producers, Steve Lichtai and Andy Bowers. Email us. The email address is slatemoney@slate.com. We want all of your love for Kathy because she loves getting love from listeners. And
I love you guys too.
And give us some ideas for other people, especially non-journalists, who might be able to fill her shoes. And, you know, if we can't do it, then you'll just have to listen to the rest of the Panoply Network, which is at itunes.com/Panoply. So we will talk to you next week on Slate Money. Chugging like the Duda man once told me you got to pay your hand. Sometimes the cards ain't worth a damn if you don't lay them down.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.